Every day, millions of men go to work questioning their purpose and how to leverage their gifts for the advancement of God's kingdom. Join us as we hear stories from other men just like you and me who have discovered the answer and are willing to share some wisdom they've learned along the way. Gathering wisdom is like dropping pennies in a jar. Over time, our jars fill up and overflow into the lives of others. Welcome to The Drop.
Welcome to The Drop. My name is Michael Pick, and we're here today with Dr. Rene Bravo.
Hello.
thank you for coming today, Dr. Bravo.
Well,
I appreciate
it. I'm honored to be here.
All right. Thank you. So, hey, can you tell me a little bit about your family?
Well, I am married wonderfully to my wife, Debbie. I have five sons, no daughters, sadly, but I have three wonderful daughter-in-laws, and I have five grandchildren, and I've lived in San Luis Obispo County here since about 1986. And I'm a pediatrician. I've been practicing here for a long time, still waiting to get it right.
Okay, practicing, that bad
yeah,
joke.
That's bad.
My sons go to you, so yeah, I think you do a fantastic job. So tell me about your a little more about the ages of your sons and where you're at in that journey.
Well, boy, I tell you, I'm at the point now, I'm not retiring, so just to dispel that rumor that seems to always see it be out there, but I'm at the end, the closer to the end of my career than the beginning. I'm in the stage of life now where I'm making preparations to slow down a little bit. Not too much going to slow down. My sons are mostly out of the area now. It's just my wife and I. I don't want to say we're empty nesters because that seems to jinx it sometimes. But we've got grandkids and we're just enjoying life now. And I still practice full time in my office. I have wonderful partners. And, I consider it really quite an honor to still be serving the kids around here and the families, and that never goes away.
What brought you to San Luis Obispo?
You know, good question. I didn't know anybody when I got here 35 years ago, but what happened here was I was trying to figure out where to go professionally. I had been a resident at Stanford. I was a resident in pediatrics. And I actually was going to stay at Stanford and do a neonatal intensive care fellowship. That's what I was trained to do, and that's what I wanted to do. But, you know, something tugged at me to look at the Central Coast. So one weekend, actually, we came down here camping, and my children, little tiny kids at the time, were enamored with this place called Grover City. They thought Grover from Sesame Street lived here. Mm-hmm. And so I took more close attention to it, and you know what? It filled every one of our check boxes. It was halfway between San Luis Obispo and Los Angeles, between our families at the time where they lived, and it was just a beautiful place to be. And more importantly, we kind of felt this is where we needed to be, my wife and I. And the rest is history. We came here. I was offered a job before I finished my residency, and I joined the San Luis Clinic right across the street here on 4th Street. And it's been quite a journey, to be honest with you. I went from knowing very few people to knowing a lot of people on the Central Coast. But God blessed us along the way, and my journey has never been better.
So tell me about backing up a little bit. So you did your residency at Stanford.
Correct.
Did you go to undergrad elsewhere?
Yes. I grew up in Los Angeles. I was born in Florida, in Miami, to parents who... My dad was a welder. He was an immigrant from Ecuador. My mother was from Cuba. And then we emigrated here to Los Angeles, raised in Bell, in the inner city of Los Angeles. And then I went to Point Loma Nazarene College. It was known as Point Loma College then. I remember when I was in high school, I was supposed to go to USC. Everybody from my high school went to USC. They would come and recruit us. And USC was only 7 or 8 miles from where I lived. But, you know, Point Loma, some went right before we were supposed to accept our scholarships, because I was scholarship to USC. Somebody said, you ought to check out the Nazarene School in San Diego. And, you know, I was raised in the Nazarene Church. And so I went over to Point Loma, man, and that's where I was supposed to be, I'll tell you, within like four and a half to 5 seconds. I figured
it's
out
that. It's a beautiful
campus. Oh, man, yeah, compared to, you know. And so God sent me in that direction, and I that's where I, you know, had some really powerful personal experiences. And the most important thing I got out of Point Loma was a young lady that I met there who touched my life and became my wife, and I am forever grateful to that. I'm now a trustee there on the board of trustees at the college, and it was a great place for me developmentally and in developing my spirituality.
So when you went to Point Loma after deciding against USC, did you go there with the intent of becoming a doctor?
Absolutely. See, I was my journey to become a physician was different than people would imagine. I didn't have any role models growing up that were doctors, but I had a very important experience when I was 12. I was diagnosed with lymphoma and cancer. Actually, the morning of the big Sylmar earthquake of 1971, you know, everybody, I remember when that earthquake happened, and for those of people who are from Los Angeles who were there, everybody remembers the Sylmar earthquake of 71 because it was a huge earthquake. Killed a lot of people, too. But I remember as I woke up that morning, getting up, it was dark, the house was shaking, and, you know, old Bravo, I was like every man for himself. See, I ran out of the house. I didn't wait for my family or anything, and I fell down the stairs. And so everything, you know, and it shook for about a minute. But anyhow, I remember my mom coming out and kind of found me outside in my underwear on the floor, and I'd hurt my leg. So I was taken to the hospital, and while at the hospital, you know, I was fine. I didn't break anything. But while at the hospital, they noticed a lump, and they said, "What's this?" And I said, "It's a lump. Come on, doctors, you know that." And they looked at it, and a really smart resident at orthopedic hospital said, they sent me to the Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, and from there they did a biopsy and they found cancer. So that earthquake changed my life. I don't think they would have found it if it wasn't for that earthquake. And then from there, I went through surgery and radiation therapy, and I was at the City of Hope for it was a journey, a tough journey, but during that time I grew up real fast, and it was that experience that really led me in the direction of being a physician, because it was during that time I can definitely say that I felt that this is what I wanted to do. I remember at that time struggling as a teenager with their own mortality. I made a lot of deals. I made a lot of deals with God at that time. And one of them was, you got to get me out of this. But it's another story. It's a long story, to be honest with you. But out of that came my desire to practice medicine and to understand what it is to be a patient and what it is to be sick and what it is to know that there's more to life than just all the stuff that we do. So that was a very seminal event in my life.
How long were you in treatment? Did you have to fight this
as
a young man?
Well, you know, for 5 years, every month they would remind me about it. And when you're a teenager, you really are not interested in being reminded about this. You want to go on. And I'll tell you, if you look for the basic, you know, Billy Graham story, this isn't it. Because I fought it. I mean, I didn't understand why the adults were so upset. You know, there were, when I went to church, for example, I was in the church at that point. You know, there were looks of pity that would come up towards me, and I didn't like that either. And then they would pray for me and put greasy oil on me, and it just bothered me. I was a teenager. The adults were just making too much of this. But it wasn't until my dad, and he was a my dad was a wonderful man. He used to sit right over there. You know, when we would come here in the last year of life, my dad came to me one day and he said, you know, and he was crying. My dad never cried. And he was a factory worker. He was a welder. And he said, you have something that may kill you. Had no other way of saying it. It was at that point that a transition occurred in me when I realized that this is real and it was serious. But that point on, though, I talked to God quite a bit. I questioned him and I asked him about why this was happening. He never gave me a clear answer, but you know what? Now looking back in life, I knew exactly why it happened, because that's why I'm here.
Okay.
And so that's a long answer to that. And during those years, seminal years of my life, school, I wrestled a lot with God. You know, you'd think that suddenly you would be saved, but I had to discover myself, and I did through that journey. But the Lord healed me. The Lord transformed me, and the Lord gave my parents lots of promises, which he fulfilled through that.
That's a remarkable story.
Well,
earthquake, naked leg injury to a doctor.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about taking a bad situation and turning it into something good.
It was something that I never forget. And I'll tell you personally, if you want to know my own philosophy, I never take a single day for granted since then. I have always taken every day since then as a gift. Once a year, I sign my name in a little Bible that was given to me in 1968. I still have a little Bible from Sunday school, and I sign my name. And it's kind of a personal memoir that I have to myself, that every year that I'm alive, I just sign one more time and a date. But God has been very gracious and very merciful to me. I do not deserve the things that he has given me, yet I have always vowed that I would continue to work for his glory, work for his honor, and recognize that the Almighty is powerful, he is all-knowing, and he is wise. And no matter what travails or problems that I've faced in this existence on earth, I have always given that credit to the Lord. And that's really flavored my journey. And so you can't really know me without knowing that. And I tell this to my partners too. I mean, you know, not everybody has the same feeling towards the Lord as I do. I recognize that, but they got to know that about me to understand who I am.
Tell me a little bit about this motivation when you were a young man going through this cancer. Was it there a specific person that inspired you to become a physician, or was it just the circumstance?
I think it was more the circumstance. I was very respectful of the oncologist at the City of Hope, Dr. Rosen. But it became quite an interesting thing because once you'd go there, you'd have they do blood work, needles, lumbar punctures, radiation therapy, all that sort of thing. But during the whole process, this is what kind of inspired me and makes me go. I sat in a room with I noticed a lot of kids that were going through it too. And one by one, I watched them all disappear. And that was that still to this day, I can't really think a lot about that. But I watched a lot of kids go through the same thing I went through and not come out of it. In fact, you know, I'll just say this. As I've shared this before, but I remember my very first crush was a young lady who was going through it too. But we'd always bring our homework and sit on different sides of the waiting room. But we were at that curious age where you notice each other. And then one day she wasn't there anymore. And then that was powerful for me because you mature real quickly when you go through things like that. And I took those experiences when I went to Stanford as a physician too, because I remember with great empathy and great love how these kids, when they go through things like that, it's, you know, the adults have to be very careful. And I never forgot that. But again, I always take this back to Jesus, because without Jesus, I wouldn't be here. Without Jesus, I wouldn't have had the life that I have. Now, one of the things that I will give you as a witness and a testimony is it didn't really dawn on me, but by about the fifth year, they were following me at the City of Hope. And this is, you know, radiation therapy, especially in where I had it, would render you sterile. It would render you without the ability to have kids. I remember that discussion because I was like 17 and they told me, well, you're probably not gonna have any kids. And I said, well, that's great. Hooray, you know?
Who cares? How am I supposed to take that?
Yeah, who cares? Right. I mean, yeah. You know, when you're 17 and you're, you know, you're feeling pretty good about life, you don't care about having kids, and that was me. And so it didn't really, you know, okay, fine, go to college and have life and stuff like that. But then I met somebody my senior year of college that I really fell in love with, and she was wonderful. And that really didn't come until then. I remember when I met my wife, Debbie, and I wasn't looking to get married or anything. She just kind of really, this is one of those other stories where it's love at first sight. I met her and maybe four or five minutes later, boom, I knew this was the one. And here's a guy that really was not looking. I just didn't, I enjoyed the single life, to put it that way. But when I met the one that I was meant to spend my life with, I remember sitting across from her and for many, many weeks, I didn't tell her, and she shared me her heart. You know how young couples are, and she said, and she wanted a big family. She wanted all this stuff, and I really didn't come from a big family. So I remember the moment when she said she wanted a big family. I said, how's that going to work? Okay, and then it dawned on me that I couldn't have kids. So I told her, it took me a long time to tell her, but I told her we couldn't have kids. And I remember that very moment, again, it's another one of those God moments, where the Lord said, we don't have incomplete miracles. And she looked at me and she said, well, then we won't, but whatever we want, whatever happens, it's in God's hands. That was it. She sold me there. She had sold me before, but she sold me as a woman who said, I trust the Lord, we trust the Lord. Now, why that's important is because in 1981, I could have kids. The Lord not only saved me, but he healed me. And the physicians, and I'll tell it, you know, doctors, I'm one of them, we're not always right all the time. So, but that was incorrect too. And my mother was given that promise that we could always have kids. And so that was a miracle, personal miracle to us, because I saw all the test results and we still had kids.
Wow.
You know, five times. Yeah. What God didn't tell me, though, is that we couldn't have daughters. So we had five sons.
Yeah.
But again, I give credit to the Lord, because that was also an important part of my journey. Because the divine has always, I've always looked for him in my life and in my journey as a physician and as a father and as a husband and as a citizen. And God's out there all the time. We just have to see him. And that's what I tell people all the time. You can choose not to see God, or you can choose to see God, but it's your choice. He's there. And I have, you know, this whole journey has always been for me that, the choice to see the Lord in everything that we're doing.
So how do you do that?
Well, it's a good question. I'll tell you how I do it. You know, one of the things that I did when I was a resident, I had the opportunity to interact with all sorts of really good people, solid people, physicians, professors in medicine, both at the University of California in San Francisco and at Stanford. And these are good people. And I'll tell you what, some of them were atheists, some of these were agnostics. But the very first thing I'll tell you is that they were all good people. And so I will not judge them adversely. But we would have, in the long times that we'd be together at night on call in the hospitals, dealing with deaf and the infirm, questions of God, a supreme being, or an imaginary friend. We would always have that debate. Is God an imaginary friend that all of us need to maintain? Is God something that we culturally bring into our lives, and or it's given to us, or it's a cultural myth that we're born into? Or is he a real entity? Is he a being that exists, that lives in the world, that makes the world happen? That, you know, we wrestled with those questions quietly, and you just can't. And those are big moments for me in my life. And personally, it was coming to the conclusion that this is more than just a cultural belief system that we have. God is a real, powerful being that exists in the world and makes things happen. You just have to know to see him, because he's evident. And you know, it became obvious when we would talk to some of my agnostic friends. Agnostic, be nice to people who are agnostic, because they're not disbelieving, they're just needing a little bit more time. Everybody will believe. I believe. I've always said that to everybody. I said, we're all going to know. We're all going to know. So it's just, what are you going to do when you find out? Mm. And so I've always taken that question to people. There's just so much evidence of the existence of divine in medical settings, the design of the human body, the miracles of the physiologic structures that we have. All these things really point to design and purpose, and everything else doesn't really make a lot of sense. And the other thing too, you know, when we watch people die, especially in training, when people would die and go to heaven, or die, the process of dying, there was a palpable difference we would notice between people who were people of faith and people who were not people of faith, a very palpable difference in the death process. And then there was something else too, you know, a lot of residents, you know, because physicians are privileged to see and be places that a lot of people aren't able to see in the most private times of people's lives. We would see the way that belief in God would change and alter the whole process. So that's, I mean, I don't want to be morose about that, but I would, you ask me, that's mm-hmm. what I do. And that's why I've spent all of my life now knowing that this is more than a cultural belief system. God is real and he's powerful and he's out there and he cares and he loves us. But you know, and this is what I always say, I want everybody to come to that belief too. And everybody is at some day going to have to figure this one out, because last I checked, we're not getting out of this alive.
Let me ask you, so when you're in residency with all these other individuals and you're facing all this mortality, what in your background and your faith upbringing kind of let you be able to really hold on to the bigger picture?
Well, I think one of the hardest things that I had to do in learning to be a doctor, especially when I was at Stanford, and I almost became an oncologist, that was almost one of the things that I went into, was watch families with little children die. That is, even to this very day, one of the most difficult things that we all had to endure. The innocence, the death of innocence. You talk about things that bring up that challenge the idea of God. Look at, you know, the justice in a 2-year-old with leukemia passing away, or a 10-year-old with a brain tumor, or even a child who is happy 1 minute and in an accident the next, and you see all this death and your sadness. But one thing that we did notice, and it was just the differences in how children, especially little children, went to heaven, how they passed and changed out of this life. There wasn't the fear that I saw in people, the older people that I would see. You know, when I was at UCSF, I mean, I would see the older people, and especially the people who didn't have any belief systems, and there was a lot of fear there. And you could see and sense it was palpable. But when I watched little children transition to another life, there was something very different that I would see. And that's how they did it, the lack of fear, the acceptance, you know, in some cases, even the joy that I would see. You know, there was one little kid, I'll never forget him. He was, you know, he was 3, and he was dying of leukemia, and I was the house officer that day, and so we were helping, you know, with pain medication and stuff. And his parents were there, and they were Christians, they were wonderful believers, and they're here, but they're in this area. But they were playing the guitar for him, and you know, as he was dying, he started talking about wanting to go play in the playground. So, and there was a playground on the other side that he was seeing. And I was sitting in that room with him, with his parents, and they were praying. They were singing worship songs, and they were praying. And he died as he was going to play on the other side. And you don't see things like that. You don't hear of things like that. See, medicine doesn't talk about things like that because these are things that are very precious and deep. But they all point to the existence of a caring, loving divine. And so that's why I think that it's really important that we acknowledge him in everything that we do, because he's everywhere and he's wanting to do everything for us. He's powerful. And so that's my message has always been, is God is there if you're looking for him. So, and I don't want to get too emotional because these are tough things to talk about.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I'm getting a little choked up here. I couldn't imagine explaining to a parent the death of their child and why that comes implicitly with that. And just lip service about, oh, there's a greater God. Does that really impact?
I believe truly that all of us on this earth will face very, very difficult and challenging times. All of us are not immune. We're not immune from the tragedies that exist. It says that it rains on the just and unjust alike in Proverbs. But it does say that those of us who acknowledge the Lord will never walk alone in this journey. We will never be without the knowledge of consolation of a God who loves us and cares for us as much as other people. And see, that's the great difference here. And that's why I try to tell people, you know, we suffer unnecessarily on this earth. We really do, because the Lord wants to remove that from us. And so, you know, I'm not a preacher, I'm just a pediatrician, but I'll tell you, I watch this journey, and if you ask me how I sustain myself, it's through the faith that God has given me. And I'll tell you, God is merciful. Man, I mean, I don't deserve the stuff. I've not been a great guy sometimes, but God is just so merciful and so just.
So we've talked about a little bit of the why behind you, why you became a pediatrician. What does a pediatrician like you do? Tell us a regular day or week.
It really depends on what, what year and what season it is in my life. Before, when I got here, I did a lot of neonatal intensive care. I did a lot of hospital work. I helped found the NICU here, and I helped families with premature babies. And I did, and as life progressed and the hospitals changed and we got hospitalists, I do mostly outpatient now. What I do, I go into the office and I help people with their children. I see the newborns all the way up to 18-year-olds, and I deal with all the different facets of human existence in childhood. I deal with precious people, the future, I call them. Every child represents the future, and that's why I love doing it. And so that's how I look at it. Some days, and this is kind of, it's going to be corny, this is going to be corny warning, but every once in a while I ask myself, when are you going to go to work? Because I don't see it as work many times. Maybe that helps you.
Okay, that really does. I mean, so serving our community and the children in the future. So what, let me ask you, it's a very demanding job, I'd presume.
It can be. Okay. If you allow it to consume you, but I don't. I mean, to me, I enjoy it. And talking to people is not difficult for me. And I've learned some very important words in medicine, and this is what I teach residents and students that come to me. I tell them the most important words you have to know to help a patient is, I don't know, because if you pretend like you know things, you're going to be in trouble in this business. And so once you don't have the stress, you have the stress of being honest and transparent with people, you're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. You're going to be fine.
What let me ask you, how have you brought your faith? I mean, it seems like you're just transparent and you're who you are. What kind of things have you done to walk your faith out in your practice over the years? You're a very successful practice.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, just being honest and straight with people, looking for people. People, I have to remember this, and I also teach this, especially to believers who are healthcare providers. They don't come to us in the exam rooms for theological discussions. They come for us because they're sick and they need healthcare. So you have to be very careful in understanding why they're there. And when you see something that can be addressed that way, then you go for it. I just love people. I frankly, just loving and caring for them is the way that I live my faith towards them. There are some people that I come and I grieve because I know that their problems are really problems that aren't organic and they're spiritual. But then, you know, I always say recognize your limitations, but that's why I also enlist the help of counselors. I believe in counselors and good counselors. I believe in the ministry and also just going to put a plug on for here at New Life. Mm-hmm. Protect your pastors. Make sure you guys take care of your pastors. All right. Mm-hmm. You know, that's another big deal for me is making sure that the ministerial families are cared for. But back to non-commercial. I would say that I really just, I am transparent, I am honest, and I try to do my best for everybody. I know that I'm not going to have the answer for everyone, but I want them to know that they're at least cared for, because that really is something that's missing in a lot of, not only healthcare, but service industries nowadays.
So over the last 18 months or so, the world has kind of been turned upside down.
What a mess.
And I don't want to get political or anything like that, but your name has been out there a bit.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've taken flack for taking one side or the other.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I'll tell you this, you know, I look at it this way, do you get upset at a blind man who steps on your toes? No. You know, they're not trying to hurt you. And a lot of people who lash out, you know, because they're anti-vax or pro-vax or anti-mask or pro-vax, they're not doing it because they're trying to be mean. They're scared. They're legitimately scared. They're just trying to figure out what the right thing to do is. And unfortunately, I think that one of the, you know, the pandemic of 2020 is not about the virus. It's about division. It's about causing division. Division in the culture, division in society, division in the church, division between friends. I've seen people really come apart in ways that I just didn't think were possible. And so one of the things I would say that's really important, if I were to give one very solid message, we cannot lose sight of Jesus. We cannot lose sight of the Lord here, because, you know, the Lord never demanded his rights. Okay, he never demanded. In fact, the early church never demanded their rights. They went to the gallows and to the Colosseum, and they suffered and they died and they were martyred for the cause, but they never forgot to keep their eyes on Jesus Christ, the Savior, the author of all life, God. And I think during this pandemic, it's very important that we do that, because we're on the verge in many places of just splitting apart on this very issue. You know, and I'm not going to say pro, anti-vax, whatever. The world loves to see this in the church. They love to see the division, because anything they can do to neutralize the witness of Jesus or the effectiveness of the church is where they will go. There's lots of diabolical stuff in this too, but I would tell you this: it has been very hard for me. Yes, you know, it's been hard because I believe very strongly that God has given us wisdom and intelligence and science. God has given us science, but science is not God. God created the science, but we're moving in directions now that have nothing to do with the virus, and so we have to be very careful. And that's how I deal with it. I don't get mad. I don't get upset. I don't, you know, because for me, if you like the Raiders or
never,
just kidding. Or the Dodgers, no. If you like them, I'm not going to, I mean, to me, it's an opinion. And so we have to be careful to parse our opinions and to separate them from our salvation.
It sounds like you have this kind of huge, like, reservoir of love, and it comes out in your practice and how you deal with people, because you just love people. Where do you attribute that to? Is that the way you were wired, the way you were raised in the church? Can you attribute some genesis for that?
I think I would tell you that it's because God saved me, and He gave me a second chance at life. And I'm a strong personality for the people who know me. I think so. But God had to grab me by the horns a few times. But it's just because I'm really grateful to the Lord for my existence on this earth. I've never taken it for granted. And all of us know, you know, we could leave in a second. Our lives are not guaranteed on this earth. You know, and I'll tell you my testimony. I was not saved in the church. I'm gonna go a little different direction. I was saved on a bus going to a football game when I was in high school. That's moment of my salvation. And even when I was going through all the cancer, I rebelled strongly against the Lord because I was angry at Him. I didn't feel that it was just. But God came to me and revealed Himself when I was in high school. And you know, it was 1970s, mid-1970s, the Jesus people were all over the place, Jesus freaks, the whole thing. And I was going to this bus, and I sat next to a Christian named Lewis. And Lewis was a Jesus freak. Everybody in the bus knew he was a Jesus freak, and they would often taunt him and make fun of him. And I remember sitting next to him, and it was particularly vicious that day. And they were calling him all sorts of names, and it just I didn't like it. And then suddenly, when I was sitting there, I heard this little voice, and this is weird. I mean, it said, "Well, are you going to stand with him? Are you going to stand with me? Or are you going to stand with them?" And I realized that the Lord, the Holy Spirit, was at that moment saying, "Are you going to stand up for me, or are you going to deny me in front of all your friends?" And you know, when you're a teenager, you want to be cool and you want to play both sides and everything. Teens know, everybody knows, because we've all been there. Mm-hmm. But it was that moment that I knew it. It was, my heart was convicted. It was convicted powerfully. And I remember bowing my head in front of all my taunting friends and asking the Lord to give me the strength. And then I stood up and told them, if they were going to call Lewis a Jesus freak, they better call me a Jesus freak too. Wow. Because I'm one of him. And it was a powerful moment, because teenagers don't like to separate themselves like that. But that was the moment that I knew that my salvation was real. It was transformative. Mm-hmm. So that's where I got a lot of my strength. Wow. Because it was real for me.
So what kind of disciplines do you have to keep your faith fresh? What kind of things do you do to keep your marriage fresh and your parenting and your grandparenting fresh? What kind of things do you do to keep it going?
Read, study, exercise, pray. I think praying more than anything. I mean, I'm not one of these people that like goes through the Bible every year, and you know, I just don't have that much discipline, frankly, or time. But I don't beat myself up when I don't have time either. But I would tell you that my tool really is, I spend a lot of time talking to God. I really do. I always say that my prayer life is one continuous conversation. And sometimes it's not a good discussion, and sometimes it's a good discussion. I think hopefully when I get up there, the Lord's going to look at me and say, oh, he's going to shake his head, say, I knew you'd make it, you know. But I would say that prayer would be the most important and most effective thing. Communicating, and then trying to avoid things that separate you from God. Now, what do I mean by that? There are a lot of activities that men can, people can get involved in that are not God ordained. And they're not, because they take you away from God. Movies that you can watch, jokes that people tell, associations and friendships which are toxic. You got to watch those things in life, because anything that kind of takes you away from the presence of the Lord is not good for you. And the other thing, spiritual health is like physical health. You have to constantly take care of it. And if you don't complain when it becomes atrophied and you don't feel God's presence, because it kind of is your fault. You know, God never leaves you. You leave him.
So what kind of advice would you impart to, you know, that 12-year-old that's facing a terminal disease, or that 17-year-old that has to make a stand, or a young man that's in love with a woman that has to say, I can't have kids? What kind of advice would you impart to younger men growing up, or younger women growing up, at these kind of crossroad moments in their life?
I would say that don't ever believe that it's as bleak as it appears. Don't ever believe that the one decision you're going to make is going to mess up the rest of your life. Always know that God is there. He cares. He knows you better than anyone else. And it really is going to be okay. It really will be okay. That's what I tell people. Because it really will. If you just let the Lord do his thing, you're going to be fine. It may not be what you like immediately, but it will be fine.
So Dr. Bravo, we've been talking for a while, been getting to know you, and you have this remarkable history, which we haven't even, it's like the tip of the iceberg. What are some of the things that growing up and through your life that you've been through, either maybe generations before you or going forward, that have really shaped you?
I'll tell you, one of the things I give a lot of honor to and credit to is my parents. My parents never had it easy. They were immigrants to the United States. They were not raised in the church. My father had a third grade education. He's the American story. He really is the embodiment of the American dream. But he was saved in Ecuador in the 1950s by American missionaries who he met the Lord through them. And they brought him to the United States, and he always sought to have a better life. He was hardworking. But he really did teach us to work really hard too. And more importantly, my mother was magnificent, a smart gal, the youngest of six children. Her father was murdered in Cuba. He was head of a big sugarcane plantation in Santiago de Cuba, and it was a political hit. And you know, through all of that, they both came to the knowing of grace of the Lord, met and married in Miami, and raised three kids. They were hardworking people. They were smart. They were streetwise, but they always knew that it was important to love God, to honor God, and the church. The church was really important growing up. We had a good church family, a Maywood Church of the Nazarene. And it was during those times that I got a lot of good role models, a good people in the church that invested in us as we were growing up. My parents too, Boy Scouts. I did a lot of Boy Scouts. Sports were tough because of my illness, but I spent a lot of my youth. You know, it was either in church activities, scouting, hiking, all that. And just really taught me a lot about persevering, and having your mortality thrown in front of you teaches you not to take a lot of things for granted. I was not I wouldn't call myself a flippant teenager. I was a deliberate teenager. I knew exactly what I was doing. I was actually a little bit probably too confident at times in myself, but I also, my parents were very good in doing us a love of country, a love of family, a love of God, and that there was order in the world. And And you know, we weren't perfect. We were never allowed to rebel, but we knew that we were loved unconditionally, and that was really important. And then I'll tell you that, you know, the secret to, people ask me, how do you raise successful kids? I'll tell you, marry a great woman. That's the secret. Seriously, you know, because people would be surprised. I really didn't like kids. I never liked kids. I never knew I was going to be a pediatrician. Nobody told me I was going to be a pediatrician. When I graduated from medical school, I was going to be a surgeon, okay? And it wasn't until I had children, I had my first child in medical school, that I realized that I really like pediatricians and children, you know? And so I would say my second thing is just be fluid. Let things go, because if you try to control things too much, you're never going to, it doesn't go well. If I would say any other thing to raising children, children are not tough, but the challenge that they bring to you can cause you to question everything about yourself. So you've got to be pretty secure in yourself when you're raising kids, or else you're going to go back to other insecurities you have. So I would say you have to be really firm and confident in what you know when you're raising kids. The other thing too is, children are not perfect. They're always learning, especially teenagers. Teenagers are apprentice adults, so you have to approach them as you would an apprentice, because they're going to make mistakes. But always know that the fundamental foundation of all parenting needs to be that they're unconditionally loved. No matter what, they're unconditionally loved.
That's great advice. I really appreciate it. So on the drop here, we have this symbolism. It's a jar. So the drop is metaphorically dropping wisdom into people's lives. And we're hoping we're going to fill this jar up. So I want to give you this metaphorical coin to drop in our jar.
Thank you, Dr. Bravo. I have dropped the penny.
Thank you, Dr. Bravo.
Take care.
Appreciate it.